Welcome to the Mentors Project podcast, covering mentorship, books, and more. In this podcast, we interview the authors of a new series of books where we meet the men and women who mentored Western civilization. This is Dr. Roseanne Welch. For more information, visit mentorsproject.org. Our guest today is Jewel Selbo, author of Breaking Barriers, a novel based on the life of Laura Bassi, the first woman in the world to be appointed a university chair in a scientific field, after being the first woman to earn a professorship in physics at any university. In those positions, she brought Newtonian mechanics to the Italians. So I'm going to start with the question that I generally start with, which is, why does Bassi matter to us today?
I think that Laura Bassi matters because of her scientific achievements, her achievements in education, but how she championed women being able to go into academia and to follow their dreams, and for men to recognize that women have dreams too, and that the structure of society at that time was misguided.
I completely agree.
I do too.
And that's why I'm excited about this book, because we need to hear more about the women who've done science all these years. It's not like it's a new thing we're inventing.
Yes, and Laura, she was very adamant that when she was young, she was very, very smart. I would think that she might have been a genius. Even at age 5, she was reading. She was speaking 2 or 3 languages. She wasn't just worried about me getting into the university, me getting the recognition. It was always about talking to the popes at the time, talking to the academics at the time, talking to people all across Europe who were stopping women from getting higher educations and moving into fields that were not mother, daughter, and other kind of accepted areas for the women at the time. So she was always fighting for somebody else, and she fought really hard for herself also.
I love that. Everybody loves a fighter.
Yeah. She really did. And she learned chess when she was a young person with her father. And the Pope, Pope Benedict XIV, who was Pope when she was in her late 20s and into her, well, maybe 30s into her 40s, was from Bologna. So she had known him and his family for a long time. He was older than her, but they went to the same church. They were in the kind of the same social circles. When he became Pope, he just liked to be around her because he wanted her advice about the university and what was happening at the university. And so they always played chess. And during the chess games, the arguments just flowed over the chessboard. Yes, the university is fine. Bologna's the head of science, but we are not giving equality where equality should be.
She's my kind of fighter. How cool. All right, so explain to me how, with this learning chess as a child and learning all these languages, how did her childhood influence this later life's work?
She was always drawn to learning. When in the book, as you know, this is historical fiction, so I took what I could feel from my research on her, and I had to dig really deeply because not a lot of people have written about her. There's very little. There's one book out, and it's not so much about her as kind of the science of the times. But when I did my research, this was the beginning of the Enlightenment, and the salons in Bologna were very, very popular, and her father was a lawyer. He came from a poor background, country guy, but he moved to Bologna, became a lawyer, kind of got up, rose up in the field of government. And so he was involved in that social circle, and he loved learning. So the salons at the time, her dad would always go, and she would kind of try to tag along. And she would peek in and listen. And one of the first words that she heard was, "We are in the age of enlightenment. This is an age of reason. This is an age of change, where new ideas are supposed to come in and help bring about change." So she became very fascinated with that. And she was always geared towards science. To gain a laurea at the time, which is a doctorate.
A degree, right.
Men had to be very facile in about 12 or 13 subjects. Science, mathematics, English, grammar, languages, all over the place. When she went for her laurea doctorate, she showed that she was proficient in 61 topics. And it was the only way that the men would pay attention to her.
Yeah. That's quadruple what they had to do.
Right.
That's more than quadruple what they had to do. Good Lord.
And most men would take 2, 3, 4 years to complete their doctorate because you had to do defenses along the way. And when she finally got the opportunity to say, when they said, okay, you can do it, you know, you can defend your, all these things, they expected her to fail. She said, okay, I'm going to do it in 1 week because I'm afraid you'll change your mind.
How smart. I love people like that.
Yep.
Oh, cool, cool. All right, so who were the relationships in her life that fueled her when she was young and of course, as she got older? Who were her big relationships?
Well, her father was very important because he just kept opening as many doors for her as he could. She was an only child. He loved her completely. Her mother was ill, so a lot of her dad's energies went to Laura. Then her cousin, who was a priest in the big cathedral, helped her along. He was the first one to teach her Latin because you learned in Latin, you spoke in Latin. When you defended for a doctorate, you spoke in Latin. You weren't speaking in Italian, which was her native tongue.
Good Lord.
So he taught her Latin, and then she said, but I really want to learn calculus. And he goes, I'm a priest. I'm a theologian. I know Latin. I don't know anything about mathematics. So Dad came to her rescue again and found her a tutor in mathematics and ethics and logic. But that tutor said, well, I won't teach you science because that's not acceptable for a woman. So her dad again said, I will find you those tutors. So she had really good tutors along the way. The one that really stuck with her the longest was someone named Manfredi, and he was a professor in calculus.
God heavens. And just to want to do all those things is amazing, the motivation. And then to go through the trouble it took to be allowed to do all those things. You can't even imagine that kind of motivation today.
Right.
Wow. And I find in so many stories, women in these early periods, they had to have a father who believed in female education to push through all that.
Yeah.
And wish we could have biographies of these men and where they got these feminist ideas.
Right. And the thing is that, going back to what we were talking about, how she always championed women alongside her, there was a group of young women, mostly young, but maybe middle-aged too, called Zitelles in Bologna. And they were kind of one step below maybe prostitutes. But sometimes the fear was that eventually they're going to have to start selling their bodies in order to have a place to stay and to put food into their bellies. And she came across a young Zitelle named Bianca. This is in my book. It was kind of made up, but I knew that she did start a school for Zitelle, so then I had to make that character somebody real.
The relation. Oh, but that's wonderful. She started a school for women like
yes.
this.
Yes. So she started. She met Bianca, who was also very gifted, but she was, you know, living in a warehouse without a blanket, basically. She said, "I'll teach you," and her dad let her take over part of the carriage house, and they built a little schoolroom, which eventually became her laboratory, because once she got her doctorate, the same people who said a woman can't be a doctor in science and who eventually let her have her doctorate or earn her doctorate said, well, fine, now you have it, but now go away.
Right.
And she said, no, I want to teach.
Yeah.
And they said, we don't want you on the university campus. So her dad said, well, let's build a laboratory in that your old schoolroom. So she built a lab. He helped her build a laboratory, and Galvani, Volta, all these amazing people came to study with her in her carriage house laboratory, really making the people at the university very angry.
And feeling stupid, which they should.
Right?
Oh, interesting. But I love that she started a school for women because it's essentially what Jane Addams is going to do, right? And that's the whole business that's just fascinating, that women with means can choose to share their knowledge with women who weren't given those privileged childhoods in order to try to build the group.
Yeah.
Wow.
Did you ever see that body exhibit that went around the country a couple of years ago? And I think it's still playing in some places where they show all the veins and all the muscles and stuff. There was a woman that she met, a real person, Anna, who was making wax figures like that. And she was just obsessed with anatomy.
Mm-hmm.
But she didn't want to get a doctorate in anatomy. She just wanted to make these figures. So she showed them to Laura, and Laura got them to use them in the hospitals and laboratories and schools for medicine.
Ah, that's wonderful.
So she was always finding all these great women who were doing extraordinary things.
It's amazing what knowing you're going against everything society has taught you, but you know what you're doing is right. That's beautiful. All right, so tell me, did she have any competitors, any other women who were trying to be at the level, or were the men who were competing with her getting in the way of what she was doing?
She really was working very hard to do the science that she wanted, because she was into experimental physics, which was not the big thing at the time. It was all theory. Uh-huh. And it was later in life when she got the head of the physics department at Collegio Montalto that she was able to introduce experimental physics into the curriculum. So she was always very focused on her laboratory, on her school. I don't think she felt competitive, at least from what I could research, with anyone in particular, male or female. It was just, let me do this. This is what I love.
Tell me, in all this research, and that there wasn't a ton of material, but what was the coolest thing you discovered along the way, the most interesting fact about her that you were able to then leverage into the story?
One of the interesting things was that she lived in the Papal States. At that time, Italy was not a unified country, and she lived in the Papal States. So not only was the Pope the head of the church, he was also the government head,
right.
And he controlled all the money, and the universities were supported by the government / Pope. So there was only one Pope along the way that had any interest in academia or science. So every time they would make a little bit of headway, the Pope would die. The next Pope would come in. They would have hope that maybe this Pope was going to give them some money. So they were always struggling to get enough funds to actually go forward in the Enlightenment. So that was interesting because I don't think I thought about it before, just how controlling and how important the popes were to her life. What was fascinating to me, because I had just written a play about Mary Shelley.
That's true.
And that also came about during the advent of electricity and the idea of electricity. So when I started researching on Laura, I was like, oh my God, this goes right down to what I'm interested in right now. Because electricity was just it wasn't understood.
Correct.
Towards the end of her life was when Ben Franklin did the whole kite thing. So we're working our way up there. Galvani did the little frog thing with the electric thing so that the dead frog's legs would jump around.
And Volta's going to show up here, right, as you said.
And Volta.
Exactly.
And Abbe Nollet was doing, had gotten permission to do an experiment called the electric boy around Europe. And I'm going to probably mispronounce the man who actually came up with this. His name is Mohsen Schoenaerts or something like that. Nollet came to Bologna at her invitation because she kept up an amazing correspondence. She would write to Newton. She would write to Voltaire. She would write to all these great scientists, and many of them would write her back. So when she was having trouble trying to get her doctorate and to get them to even let her try for her doctorate, she had all these great scientists writing recommendations for her. Well, a lot of them started coming to Bologna, and they didn't want to go to the university. They wanted to hang out at her lab and be with her. Abbe Nollet came to Bologna to work in her lab, and they did the electric boy. They did this thing where they did circles of monks, and they would do a sulfur ball, an electric charge kind of thing. However they did it, I explain it very well in the book.
Which is why people need to buy the book.
And you would see the electrical charge coming through everybody. So she was always fascinated with lightning, electricity. What is it? Is it in our body? Because at the very end of her life, they started doing experiments where they would take a corpse and put the charges in the ear and the mouth, which would cause the corpse to sit up.
Wow.
And, you know, that was entertainment in Europe in the late 1700s.
Good, which is so weird because there was some respect for dead bodies, but then again, they were also stealing them to experiment on, so I
guess.
Yeah,
and, you know, mostly they would use criminals.
Right.
They would start with sheep and other animals, but at some point, some pope, one of the popes said, well, okay, you can do a little bit of experimentation if it is a criminal corpse.
Interesting. Well, there you go. You earned that in your post-life.
Yeah.
Oh, that's just... Well, she is sounding more and more fascinating by the day. Tell me what you think in your background helped you to work on her story and to create this historical fiction about her life.
The first is I love doing research, and I love bringing research to life and to make it accessible and a really fun read where not only are you learning some interesting but I had to do a lot of research and explain a lot of science, and I wanted to make it very accessible. But also, I think, because I was a screenwriter in Hollywood, and I'm sure women in banking and every other profession have experienced this, you get to a certain point where you go, oh my goodness, I'm not being allowed to do that, not because I'm not capable, but because I'm a woman.
Right.
So I was able to really clue into it because what she was facing was so blatant and it was so accepted, to really be able to put words in her mouth that I think I felt for a long time.
I love that, and it's sad but true that this has been an attitude for a long time, and the more we hear about women who've accomplished so much in the past, it should shut down the arguments current, because we have proof. We have proof that women can do these things and should be doing these things. You called her maybe a genius earlier, and I think that's really interesting because we have no hesitancy in calling men geniuses. But we do tend to pause. Can a woman be a genius? Well, yes, she can.
Well, I only pause, not because I don't think a woman could be a genius, just because there was no quantification of it at that time. I mean, I have no idea what her brain power was, except the fact that she was curious, smart, was able to speak. By the time she died, I think she spoke Greek, English, French, Italian, of course, and Spanish. So at least 5 languages. And she didn't actually invent anything. She was the academic who channeled everybody else's ideas and then wanted to prove them. So a real experimental physicist. Someone who said, that's what you think? Well, let's see if we can prove it. Mm-hmm. So it was very exciting. Her laboratory was so vibrant.
Being that you had only so much research to work with, you had to invent part of the story again, historical fiction. So what was your favorite scene?
I think my favorite scenes were probably the chess games, the ones with her father and the ones with Pope Benedict XIV. The editor would put check marks next to the scenes that she particularly enjoyed. When she meets the man that she's going to marry, Verratti, she bagged out on dance classes. She just didn't want to go to dance classes. And so she was at a party. Her best friend was her engagement party. So there was a dance thing, and her cousin wants to go talk to another girl. So he leaves her with this guy who she doesn't know. And he says, well, I guess we should dance. And she says, well, I don't dance. He goes, well, let's just promenade because I don't dance either, but we can walk around. And the whole discussion was about the light, the storm outside, the idea of electricity, while they're walking in and out of this, the party and everybody dancing, and her mom and dad are trying to look over the hats and the feathers of the women so they could see our daughter. She's talking to a man. Who could this be? I like that scene because I think it's very active and pretty. But the chess scenes, I think, is where she really gets to speak her philosophy about gender equality.
Which is beautiful. And again, active, because you can visualize. We know what a chess scene looks like. And playing chess with a man is, again, another equalizing moment, which I think is really cool.
And then eventually she tells Pope Benedict, checkmate.
Oh, that's perfect. Yay. Yay. Did you find any themes that ran through her life?
What was interesting about Laura is that she was relentless, and she often had to suppress her temper and just be able to use her words, as we say to children, use your words. But she was relentless, dogged. She was never going to give up. And she used correspondence and talking to people in order to eventually get in a position to be able to do what she wants. So I think the theme would be something like, without dogged determination, you may not reach the ultimate goal of your life. And I loved seeing her do that, because every time she had so many doors crashed into her face. And every time she would go, there's got to be another way. There's got to be another way. And she found it.
She found it each time. You just mentioned, of course, that she was married. Did she have children?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Along the way, with all this business,
she also... she had 8 children, 2 died. So she raised 6 kids and had her laboratory and taught, and she had her husband, and Bologna had embraced her. She was called the Minerva of Bologna. She was their beloved saint. They actually, before she was met Verratti, they called her, you know, the Virgin Goddess of Bologna. So then when she got engaged, they went, no, you can't get married. You're our Virgin Goddess. And she said, you know what? Thank you. I love you all too. But I have found a man who will let me do exactly as I want.
What
a
miracle.
I am going to marry him.
Yes, indeed. Oh, that's wonderful.
She was so popular in Bologna, because she wouldn't leave Bologna. She wouldn't go speak in Paris. She wouldn't do this. She said, Bologna's my city. This is where I'm busy. I have my kids. But she was always lecturing at women's clubs and at different places. They just pulled her in all directions because she was beloved. And she filled up auditoriums whenever she spoke, because she knew how to bring science to the real person.
Which is the job of a teacher.
Yeah.
So how did she then end up becoming the first woman to get a position at a university when they barely wanted to give her a lawyer? Why did they finally hire her?
Well, she was still teaching in her carriage house. She was allowed to give 2 lectures a year at the big university, University of Bologna. But that was an invited audience. She couldn't teach on a day-to-day basis. Then the second in charge of the University of Bologna in the science department moved over to be the head of Collegio Montalto. And after he got things settled, he came and said, okay, I've never agreed with the head guy over at the University of Bologna, and I believe in experimental physics. I want you to be the head of this.
Wow.
And she said, okay, I will. But here are the things that I need. I need to design the curriculum. I need to get paid the same amount as men.
Woo, what a concept.
And I need to be able to accept women into the program.
And did you win all those things?
Yep.
That's even better. Again, not just me rising, but I'm going to make sure as I rise. It's like Eleanor Roosevelt insisting that women were in her press group so that she could give them work that they could then go sell that wasn't just the society pages.
Right.
I love that. Wow. All right, so you've touched on her dad already. Would you say she had any other mentors that were very important to her?
Well, Lambertini, who became Pope Benedict XIV, helped her along the way because he was so powerful. He was the richest, came from one of the richest families in Bologna. He had like 3 doctorates himself. He was the Pope's right-hand man for many years before the Pope died. He was a cardinal for a long time. So if Lambertini wanted something, chances are people would bend over in order to help Lambertini get what he wanted. But again, he had to kind of go back channels because he couldn't like make it look like you do what I want and let her in. So he used back channels, and he had very strong friends. Marchesa Ratta, her husband had died, left her a wealthy widow. And she was very much in society. She helped set up lectures just to get everyone to know Laura and make it clear that she was extraordinary. And then Marchesa Ratta's friend, poet Algarate, he started writing poems. They just became this like little group of, let's just help her along. And he would write these beautiful poems about how intelligent this woman is. And those went all over Italy. So there were a lot of people who helped her along the way.
Beautiful. That's what I like to hear. Especially the Mentoris podcast likes to hear that, because that's always my final question, which is then who were your mentors in life?
I've had really strong mentors in my life. And I guess it's not till you get older that you actually see how much they did for you. I think my father gave me an incredible work ethic. I had a really strong family. I had three brothers, a sister, and my mother. She took care of us all. And then I had teachers along the way that were, in eighth grade, I was making films. I was writing them, directing them, editing them, and just making films after films after films and studying films. My teacher had a great library of films, and there was a group of us that would stay at school and just watch them, break them down. And then there's just so many. There was a professor, Professor Hancock in college, who just said, you know what? What year are you? And I said, I'm a sophomore. And he goes, yeah, but you kind of know this stage combat thing better than anybody else. Can you teach a class for me? Because I don't have anybody to teach that class for me. So there were just people who gave me a lot of opportunities to kind of see what I could accomplish.
Just like Laura.
Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's a beautiful tie together. Well, on that, I'm going to thank you for joining us today.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you, Roseanne.
Thanks for listening to the Mentors Podcast, sponsored by the Barbera Foundation, whose mission is to promote positive change by inspiring others to engage in their community. Your host has been Dr. Roseanne Welch. Our music was composed by Patrick Abate, technical direction by Douglas E. Welch, and Kathleen Childress designed our website. For more information and to read more about the great mentors in history, visit mentorsproject.org and join us for our next conversation.